Life.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with a man who is perhaps the best known Catholic, or perhaps I should say Christian, theologian in the world today. Certainly, he is arguably the most widely read. Our guest is Dr. Hans Küng. He is a scholar of theology and philosophy. He is the author of many books. Among his best-known titles, the books on Being a Christian and Does God Exist? He studied philosophy and theology at the Gregorian University in Rome, at the Sorbonne, and at the Institut Catholique in Paris, the Catholic Institute of Paris. He is president of the Foundation for a Global Ethic. From 1960 until his retirement in 1996, he was professor of ecumenical theology and director of the Institute for Ecumenical Research at the University of Tübingen in Germany. He served also in the late 60s, or early to mid-60s, perhaps better to describe it, served as official theological consultant to the Second Vatican Council, appointed by Pope John XXIII. He was the drafter of the Declaration Toward a Global Ethic of the Parliament of the World's Religions in 1993. And that's what it is that we'll be talking about here this morning. He has said, famously, that there can be no peace among nations without peace among religions, and no peace among religions without dialogue between the religions. And it was an effort, I think, to foster this kind of dialogue that he started the project called Global Ethic, that was aimed at finding out what religions have in common and developing a set of principles that everyone, no matter what their faith, could agree on. And the question we'll look at this morning is, indeed, can there truly be that kind of consensus among the world's faithful? And as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, and indeed anyone who's listening, if you're listening on the internet and you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Küng, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Good morning, David.
Perhaps you might start by talking a little bit about the genesis of the idea of the global ethic. I know this is something that certainly you have been thinking about for a long time. I'm sure even before it was established in a kind of a formal sense with the Declaration back in 1993. When did you start thinking about this?
Well, I started to think about when I had dialogues with other representatives of world religions already in the 80s. I discovered that, of course, the differences in faith, in dogma, and systematic doctrine among the different religions are tremendous. But that in ethical standards, in rules of behavior, there is a great deal of consensus. And I was just interested to find out what are these common values, what are these common ethical standards, what are common attitudes. And that was a great discovery to see that there are a few ethical standards which are really universal for all the different religious traditions and also philosophical traditions.
You, I know, are not arguing for the idea of world religion, that is, that everyone could subscribe to the same set of beliefs. However, you have argued for this kind of consensus, an effort to achieve some sort of consensus on a set of ethical principles that everyone can live by. And it seems that when you do that, and also when you talk about taking those beyond the piece of paper that they're printed on and using those in determining how you're going to live your life, that you are going beyond what is conventionally, I think, thought of as interfaith dialogue. What point is there between the two, between a kind of a conventional interfaith dialogue and a world religion. Is it really possible that there can be some kind of meaningful consensus?
Well, I think there is, of course, this a new approach to the world religions in a way that we are not discussing only in an abstract, general way that we need peace. I think we can easily agree in principle, but we have to work out where this peace is rooted and why we can live together. Of course, there is no system of ethics which is in common. And global ethic does not mean that we need a common ethical system like the system of Aristotle or Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages or Immanuel Kant in modernity. But it is a fact that, for instance, all great religious traditions have the golden rule: do not do to others what you do not want to have done to yourself. That you will find already 500 years before Christ in the Analects of Confucius in China. You will find it in the Buddhist tradition, in the Hindu tradition, and of course you find it in the Hebrew Bible, in the New Testament, and also in the Muslim tradition. That is only one example that we have common ethical standards, and what is new is not so much that we have new rules, but that the consciousness of these rules is new. I discovered when I made research that there are, as a matter of fact, not only this general rule of the golden rule, but all the other religions also share the conviction on other ethical standards.
Can
you speak a little louder, please?
Yes, sir. I continue to go back to that quote that is so often repeated, that there can be no peace among nations without peace among religions, and think about the fact that while it is true that you can find this kind of ethical common ground, we do seem to have difficulty in that so many religions make claims of exclusivity. That is, they claim that they have a hold on the truth, and as long as you subscribe to their version, then you'll be fine, and if you don't, then you're in trouble. How does one deal with that tendency of religion to say, we have the truth and you don't? How does one get around that?
Well, I would not dismiss the approach of many religious people that they have the truth. As a Christian, I really believe that for me, Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. I have only to agree and to see that, for instance, for Jewish people, it is the Torah which is the way, the truth, and the life. And for Muslim, it's the Quran, etc., etc. So we need at the same time two different dimensions, as we have it in many ways in our life. What is for me is not already for all the others. And so we have these two dimensions, interior dimension, in which I say, well, that is my faith conviction. I am rooted in this faith. I shall not give it up. And this is true for me as a Christian, for me, for my friends in Judaism, for in Islam, everywhere. They have their own way. But on the other hand, they can agree that, of course, we have to accept that there are different ways. And we should not deny that they have some truth. It doesn't mean that we have to agree with everything, but that they agree with us on certain truths, and now especially on ethical standards. I think if a Jewish person or a Muslim person reflects on ethical standards, he or she will come to the same ethical standards. For instance, you shall not murder, torture, torment, wound, in positive terms, have reverence for life. I think we can all have a commitment to a culture of nonviolence and reverence for life. That's one important axiom, one more important standard. A second is you shall not lie, deceive, forge, manipulate, in positive terms, speak and act truthfully. We should all have a commitment to a culture of truthfulness and tolerance. The third is you shall not steal, exploit, bribe, corrupt, in positive terms, deal honestly and fairly. We should have all a commitment to a culture of fairness and a just economic order. And finally, the fourth, you shall not abuse sexuality, cheat, humiliate, dishonor, in positive terms, respect and love one another. We should all have a commitment to a culture of partnership and equal dignity of men and women.
Christians and Jews will recognize elements here as being echoed in or being drawn from the Ten Commandments. And other people in their traditions will no doubt recognize as well these being important principles. But the devil being in the details, I imagine that the place this gets controversial is when you start to talk about the implications of these things and you go on beyond thou shalt not kill or have respect for life, and then you start talking about what that really means to put that into practice. Then it seems that that's where it's likely that you're going to get an argument.
Yes, that's absolutely true. A global ethic does not mean that we have to agree on everything. We have only to agree on certain basic standards. If at least this would be clear, that we have not to murder innocent people, not to torture, to torment, to wound, I think that would already be a great achievement and would be enough. For instance, to exclude these terrible crimes which happened in Iraq and elsewhere. So this, I think, is basic. But if you want now to settle, for instance, the issue of abortion, you cannot presuppose a consensus among the different religions, not even among the Christian churches, and you cannot even presuppose among a consensus in one church, as the Catholic Church, where we have also different positions. Here, I think, first we have to give freedom to that there are different convictions in controversial issues. And second, that the religions and the churches would have to work for more consensus, even in the questions of dispute, which are under dispute, and so that we have then also maybe after a certain period a more common vision of what we have to say about abortion or about anti-conception or about homosexuality or about euthanasia. All these four I just mentioned are questions in which there is no agreement among the religions, neither in the question of anti-conception, nor abortion, nor homosexuality, nor euthanasia. We have just to find a way there. But it is important to keep to the general principles and not just to concentrate everything on these controversial issues.
I guess I don't mean to belabor the point, but I continue to find myself thinking that for so many people who are strongly committed to their faith, there is no such position as agreeing to disagree. Is it actually possible to do that? And that is to say, we're going to agree on the basic principles, but when it comes to how it is we apply them, we're going to acknowledge the fact that we don't all agree on that, and we're going to say that that's something we can live with. I guess I feel that there are probably a lot of people who would say, well, that is not something that we can live with.
Well, David, I think there is no other possibility. Even those people who say, I want that the whole world believes as I do in the question, in these controversial issues, they cannot, they have to acknowledge the simple fact that there is no consensus. And you can just try to tolerate other issues or to kill other people, as it also happened in the question of abortion. You know, it is, I think, alternative to have personal convictions and to stay in dialogue with others. That is always possible, to discuss it, to dispute it, maybe to convince others, but not to kill other people who have different opinions or to try to destroy them.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Dr. Hans Kung. He is well known as a theologian and writer. He was for a number of years between 1960 until he retired in 1996, professor of ecumenical theology and director of the Institute for Ecumenical Research at the University of Tübingen in Germany. He's president of the Foundation for a Global Ethic. And by the way, if you're interested, the organization, the foundation, has a website. You can find them there. Also, there is a book that you might look at titled Global Responsibility in Search of a New World Ethic that was published in 1993. He is the author of many books, his best known perhaps being on Being a Christian and Does God Exist? Also, recently he published a memoir, and if you would like to read about him, you can look for that book. It's titled My Struggle for Freedom. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What has happened with this movement now in over the last decade or a little bit more than a decade since the Parliament of World Religions ratified or adopted the Declaration Toward a Global Ethic? And we've talked about some of the basic points of the Declaration. What's the status of the movement today?
Well, I think it's very different countries. If you look at German-speaking countries, we developed a great deal of instruments, of possibilities how to teach global ethics in schools, not as a separate topic, but in order that different teachers of different disciplines apply these principles to concrete life. We have not only my books. We have a whole television series. Unfortunately, all this not happened in the United States, where the Declaration Towards a Global Ethic was finally promulgated in Chicago, as you mentioned it, in 1993. But it would be nice to have the same things also here, to have videos for, as we have these 7 videos on ethnic religions, on Judaism, Christianity and Islam, but also on Buddhism and Hinduism and Chinese religions. We have CD-ROMs, we have a lot of teachers involved, we have competition among different school classes, in all that on the grassroots level. At the same time, we had, of course, also in the upper levels of politics a great deal of discussion. There was a proposal for having a universal declaration of human responsibilities, not only of human rights, by statesmen, in which also participated the American president, former president Jimmy Carter, and a lot of well-known statesmen, the former heads of state and government. We had speeches on global ethics at the University of Tübingen every year. We had first Tony Blair, Prime Minister of Britain, speaking about that. The second year it was the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, Mary Robinson, who is actually, I believe, in New York, former President of Ireland. We had then UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. And last year we had the former director of the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., and now head of the German Republic, president of the German Republic, Horst Köhler. And this year we had the Peace Nobel Prize winner from Iran, Shirin Ebadi, and we will have next the president of the International Olympic Committee. You see, these are all persons who see the importance of a common ethic of humanity, of common ethical standards in politics, in the economy, in sports, and practically in all fields of life.
We have someone who is listening who would like to join the conversation in Urbana, here where we are. And let's do that now on our line number one.
Hello. Good morning. Yeah. I'd like to commend WILL for having this guest. I'm really pleased to hear this.
Can you speak a little louder?
Yeah, I can. I'm happy that the station had you on. I couldn't agree with you more. The thing that I find out in a personal way is when I approach someone or they approach me whose religious beliefs are very different, I can really detect fear in them in acknowledging any kind of acceptance of someone who has a belief different from them. And I never know how to proceed because you can see that what they would see that being as a slippery slope, that once they acknowledge someone had the right to think differently and they have been taught that theirs is the only way, that this might be like a hole in the dike and everything would crumble for them. And I'm going to hang up and see how you respond to that. Thank you.
Well, that's, of course, I think a very justified but also a difficult question to answer. I think the more a person is, so to speak, self-conscious and safe, so to speak, in his or her own convictions, the easier this person will have the courage to dialogue with others. I remember that Catholics, before the Second Vatican Council, I myself, I'm a Catholic theologian, I know quite well how it was before, we were generally rather ashamed or, I would say, hindered to discuss with Protestants our Catholic faith because we did not feel that we are safe and that we are not able to discuss. So you see, it is sometimes today the same thing in the dialogue with world religions. Christians who are afraid to talk about questions which are under dispute, to be afraid to talk to Jewish people or Muslim people, that's the reason. The main reason is they do not feel assured themselves. So I think it would be necessary in the dialogue first to listen to them, not to be intrusive, not to be too offensive. I think listen more and speak less.
Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As I mentioned, and as you mentioned, you were associated with this effort, the Second Vatican Council. You were appointed by John the 23rd as a consultant to the council. This was in the early to mid-1960s. I'm interested in having you talk about what you think the council achieved and generally this idea that this ecumenical project, what that's about, what it achieved, and yet what you think is where we need to be going from here with this project.
David, that's again a very complex issue. I try to answer it in a rather short way. I, looking back at this great events of the 4 years of the Second Vatican Council, in which I participated together with my colleague then in Tübingen, Joseph Ratzinger, who is the actual Pope Benedict. I think we all saw this progressive majority that it is necessary to integrate, as I would formulate today, two paradigms at once. The first is the paradigm, the constellation, the model of the Reformation to take up, I think, justified desires of the reformers, that means vernacular language, a liturgy of the people, a higher importance of the laity, the importance of women in the church, also decentralization and adaptation of the church with the different nations. That all were desires of the reformers. Second, we also needed to integrate the paradigm of the Enlightenment and or modernity, which was very important, especially for the American participants, to accept religious freedom, freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, to accept what we condemned a long time, what the popes condemned in the 19th and first half of the 20th century, the human rights, a new attitude towards the Jews, but then in consequence also a new attitude to Muslims and to the other world religions, and in general to the modern secular world, a positive approach to science and all the further developments in all criticism. So you see, we had integrated, I think, to a great part this two paradigms. But we were not consistent, and come now to the negative points, to be rather short. The council was not allowed to be consistent because the curial minority controlled the power in the council. So there was forbidden to discuss the issue of celibacy, which is now at the root of many scandals in the clergy in America, in Ireland, in Austria, in other countries. I think, which is one of the roots why we have so many scandals. We were forbidden to talk about the pill, and we got the encyclical Humanae Vitae, which was really, I think, the main element why the authority of the church declined after 68. We were not allowed to discuss the common Eucharist between Catholics and Orthodox and Protestants. And we also were not, it was not a real possibility to discuss papal absolutism and authoritarianism of the Roman Curia. All this was made indirectly, but not directly. And so you see, the troubles we have since the Second Vatican Council were always these issues. And we just had a new synod of bishops, which again was without results, because the main thing is we did not have a real reform of the power structure of the Catholic Church, which is still medieval, counter-reformation, anti-modern power structure. And I wrote also a little book about short history of the Catholic Church, where I developed the thesis that all this comes basically from the 11th century. The first millennium was, I think, rather different. We did not have this sort of clericalism, this sort of papal absolutism, this law of celibacy and other things. So, you see, there are people in our own Catholic Church, as in all the other religions, who are living in different paradigms. There are Catholics, but also Jews, Protestants, Jews and Muslims and other. They live in the medieval paradigm, and they are, of course, in conflict with those people in the same church, in the same religion, who are living in the postmodern paradigm, which is the paradigm which is coming up since World War II.
Well, there you have pointed to the issues that are at the root of the conflict that's been going on now, I think, for some time between you and some of the leadership of the church, particularly the last pope, John Paul II, and also, I think, there no doubt between you and Pope Benedict. And I think that the position that you've laid out and the concerns that you have about these particular issues, you'll get a lot of agreement with many American Catholics. I'm not sure about Catholics in other countries, but certainly many Catholics in this country would agree with you that they would like to see some changes in this direction, and they are concerned about the authoritarian, one might say, medieval structure of the church. But it seems that at the moment that the leadership of the church is not amenable to the idea of changing in these ways. And their response often to the Catholics who raise these questions is basically to tell them to sit down and be quiet. And it doesn't seem that there's going to be much change in this direction anytime soon. And I wonder whether you're particularly optimistic that change in these areas can occur?
Well, we are in a difficult situation, no doubt about that. I think, just speaking here from Philadelphia, Wendt's report on sexual crimes of the clergy in the last, I do not know, 50 years or so, was published. There was, opposition even among the present Catholics, traditional Catholics in Philadelphia and elsewhere. If you see the reactions of Catholics in Ireland or in Austria, where we had also this kind of sex scandals, you will understand that it is more and more difficult for the Roman authority to insist just on the law of celibacy and to say, we shall not change. What started as scandal in the Archdiocese of Boston, and I gave my first lecture in my big lecture tour in the great year of John F. Kennedy and John 23rd in Boston College, I remember the tremendous credibility the church had under Cardinal Cushing up there. And what is now, after these things which happened under Cardinal Law, and you see, I could go on with all these examples which show that I think the challenges will be bigger and bigger for the Roman authorities who do not want to change. I think that's one reason why I believe still that after a certain time we have to move again. The second is, finally, the Roman authorities do not have Jesus himself with his authority behind them if they insist on the law of celibacy and other things which are disputed, because Jesus himself didn't want to have his disciples or even his apostles to be without women. That is quite clearly from the Gospels. And we have in the pastoral epistles a clear affirmation that the bishop should have one wife, not more, but he can have one wife. You see, here we are in blatant contradiction with the Christian message itself, and I don't believe that we can go on like this. Of course, David, it will depend on the people themselves. If they do not revolt, if they do not speak out, if also our priests, who are now deeply wounded by these developments, our good priests, and I'm still a Catholic priest in good standing, if they do not speak out against the system and to ask for change, then we have not to complain. But I have the impression here, what I heard here just arriving here in Philadelphia, even in very traditional parishes, they were now quite upset with all this, which is a consequence of a system which is not only in sexual matters quite ambivalent, but also in the power structure, that if a bishop is just following the Roman party line, he can do a great deal of things which are even immoral, as in the case of the transfer homosexual priests who have made crimes and other matters. You see, these are questions which cannot be silenced in the next future.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Hans Kung. He is a scholar of theology, philosophy. He has authored many books. If you're interested, you certainly can find them in the library, the bookstore, some of those that we have mentioned. The titles that are probably best known have been most widely read, his books On Being a Christian and Does God Exist? Also, the recent title, The Catholic Church, A Short History, if you're interested in some of those issues. And if you're interested in learning about him, you can look at his memoir, My Struggle for Freedom. He's president of the Foundation for a Global Ethic. He was for a number of years until he retired in 1996, professor of ecumenical theology and director of the Institute for Ecumenical Research at the University of Tübingen in Germany. And he is also drafter of the Declaration Toward a Global Ethic, of the Parliament of the World's Religions that was adopted in 1993, and we've talked about some of the ideas in that document. Currently, at the moment, he's spending some time in the United States and was good enough to come on the show this morning talking with us by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller next to talk with in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I wanted to explore two areas, one with one economics and the other science, and how, and well, to start with, recently the Dalai Lama in the New York Times did an op-ed piece, and he said, quote, "If science proves some belief of Buddhism wrong, then Buddhism will have to change," unquote. And when you were talking about a common ethic, I was wondering if you thought there was any chance the religions of the world would ever get to that kind of have some agreement on that one point, that if science proves something, some belief is wrong, then the religion itself should change.
Yes, I think that's a very good question. Very good question. I even discussed this in a personal meeting with Pope Benedict XVI because I was just giving a speech to the European Academy of Natural Scientists and Philosophers, speaking about the origin of the world. And I sent the book The Beginning of All Things, that is, will be published, I hope, next year in America, with the relationship between science and religion, The Beginning of All Things. I sent to the Pope before I arrived in Castel Gandolfo, and I was very happy to see that also Pope Benedict takes this very, very seriously, that we need urgently a dialogue between science and religion. And we nevertheless changed already a great deal, I must say. If you remember the case of Galileo, there was an excuse for that. It was not very consistent what John Paul II has done. It wasn't a little ambivalent. Nevertheless, I think nobody would anymore defend among the even Roman authorities to take literally the first page of the Bible. And we have just to take seriously what are the facts of sciences. I know that in the present moment you have a great discussion in America about intelligent design and about all the problems of Darwinism. I have more than one chapter about these problems in this forthcoming book, in which I developed the vision that we have to accept what are all the convincing results of modern cosmology, astrophysics, biology, especially molecular biology, which you cannot just disapprove. We have just to accept all that. And we have not to say that this is already a proof for an intelligent design. No, it's not the proof for intelligent design, but it is nevertheless a question whether there is not an intelligent design. And this question can be answered only by faith and by your religious conviction, and not by a scientific argument. I think a lot of difficulties we would avoid if we would have a clear distinction between what science can do and achieve, and what religion and faith can say and explain. My whole line would precisely be to accept everything what the sciences say, what are real facts you cannot just dispute, to accept all that, and then to see what we can say from the Christian side. I can explain perfectly what is on the first page of the Bible without being in contradiction with anything which was said in physics or astrophysics or biology. So we, I am for a new model of integration, a model of how to say it in English. You see, I am poor in my English. We need a concept which is not the opposite, a model which is not in opposition to a model of opposition between science and religion, but of complementarity. That is the word I was looking for. A complementary vision of both. There are things religion cannot explain, but there are also other questions science cannot answer.
Yeah, that's a weakness in science. They seldom point to their own shortcomings. They don't like to acknowledge them. But I had another question, and this time about economics, and that is that you said that that Catholicism calls for fairness and for not oppressing people. But the thing that bothers me the most about it is that greed is not really decried in any kind of meaningful way. And I think that the last Pope's reaction to liberation theology in particular was caused a lot of suffering in Latin America in particular. And I'm just wondering in terms of common ethics, is fairness, does that preclude greed? Do you think that would be a common ethic? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you are right. I just said, and I think here we have a perfect agreement with liberation theology. Leonardo Boff also has written now, I was very happy to see that, recently, a book on global ethics, which is very much in agreement with my own views. And it is quite clear in this context we have to apply in a very strict way that also companies are not allowed to steal, exploit, bribe, and to corrupt. That is true for all companies in American and European companies in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia. I think deal honestly and fairly is certainly a thing we have to be more conscious of all that. Unfortunately, there is also in the economy an increasing consciousness of the fact that globalization of the economy and technology, which is not followed or supported by a globalization of ethics, will be to the damage of humanity. We have already enough examples where unethical globalization really hinders whole nations to find this kind of happiness which you have in the American Constitution. The pursuit of happiness is not guaranteed without having some ethical standards also in the economy. And the most recent scandals we had in Wall Street and in the stock market, and all these things of the big companies which falsified the balance sheets, etc., etc., all this shows how important ethics is. And the former president, the acting director of the International Monetary Fund, who is a member of our Foundation for Global Ethics, the present president of German Republic, Dr. Horst Köhler, said quite clearly, globalization of the economy needs a global ethic.
We have several other callers. We will try to get in one or two. I'm afraid we may not be able to get them all, but we'll see what we can do. The next in line is in Indiana, in Rensselaer, Indiana, line number 4.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Kung, first...
Can you speak a little louder, please?
Yes. My compliments on your contributions to theology all these years. My question, you emphasize dialogue, but in the development of a global ethic, what's the role of common worship across denominational and religious lines? And I'll take my question off the air.
Well, thank you for the call.
Well, very briefly, I think global ethic is not so much concentrated on global ethic is just an answer for ethics, not for worship, because worship is, in general, a different thing from ethics. Nevertheless, I think if we would have common ethical standards, it would, of course, also help our common worship. And with regard to this issue, I think we have to see that, especially for the three prophetic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, we address the same God. We address the God of Abraham, of the Hebrew Bible, of the New Testament, and also the Quran is appealing to the same God, because even Christians, Arab Christians, if they address God, they call him Allah. So that is the basis why we can have some prayers, of course, without then mentioning what is different. We can address the same God, but not if we are preaching together. We cannot just end the prayer with "through Jesus Christ our Lord," because this is disputed. But we should take what is in common, and I think a lot of psalms could be used, a lot of prayers from different religions could be used to have also common worship.
Let's go next to a caller in Kankakee. This is line number 2. Hello.
Will you please discuss Roman Catholic relations with Eastern Orthodoxy and the prospects for Christian unity on the basis of a collegial Orthodox Christianity? Thank you.
I believe that Pope Benedict would like to have some agreement with Orthodox. He is very much interested to have better relations with the Orthodox. The problem is, of course, complex, and I think we would have to reflect what should be corrected. The Orthodox churches have often the impression that, that especially in Russia, the Roman Catholic Church founded too rapidly seats of bishops in Siberia and elsewhere only because there was a small community. I think we have to be more restrained, not to give the impression that we make proselytism in Russia and in other Orthodox countries. On the other side, I think some Orthodox churches are often too reluctant to speak with Rome, especially the church in Greece or some churches in the Near East. I think here we need more openness, as, for instance, the Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople showed. He is a very open man, and he showed how we can talk to each other. Ultimately, to make it short now, of course, there is the question of papal primacy and infallibility. That was the reason why I wrote the book on infallible question mark and inquiry. I think without the solution, the change of the juridical primacy into a pastoral primacy, without having jurisdiction on all these Eastern Orthodox churches, we shall not have a solution. We need urgently, I think, a restatement of these unfortunate definitions of the First Vatican Council, 1870.
We're almost out of time. There is one question I'd like to ask, and unfortunately I can't give you very much time to talk about it, but that is this. Now, certainly within many faiths, it's happening in Christianity and in Islam and in Judaism, there is a clash between modernity and its values and faith and its values. At least there are some people who think that there is such a clash. Is it possible for there to be some kind of reconciliation between those two? And in what ways do you think that religion, specifically Christianity, can change or must change in order to live in the modern world?
Well, David, you are right. That is really true for Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Certain great times were in the Middle Ages. And so a lot of people in all the three religions remained, so to speak, in the medieval paradigm, which in the Catholic Church was then fortified by the Counter-Reformation and even petrified by anti-modernism. Of course, there is a big difficulty for a church which remains, a religion which remains in the Middle Ages, be it Christian, Jewish, or Muslim, or whatever, to confront modernity. But we have shown in the Second Vatican Council that it is possible. We were not successful in everything. Nevertheless, I think also Islam has the same problems. They remained also, many of them remained in the medieval paradigm, which was the great paradigm of Baghdad. And we should help now the Muslims to find the way. Bombs on Baghdad and bombs in the Middle East and an army in the Middle East, I'm sorry to say that quite bluntly because we do not have much time, I don't think are the best way to have a dialogue. We need soft policy and not military, the hard policy, in order to settle the problems, especially in the Near East, also between Israel and the Palestinians. And I think the religions and the heads of the religions, I mean the leaders of the religions, the three religions should cooperate in order to settle the problem of the Palestinian state, to settle the problems in the Near East in general, but also in other parts of the world, to have a constructive solution and not a military confrontation.
Well, there we must stop. Our guest, Dr. Hans Kung, is president of the Foundation for a Global Ethic. You can find more about the organization on its website, and he is the author of many books, some of his best known, including On Being a Christian and Does God Exist? Also, some of the books we've mentioned, The Catholic Church, A Short History, one that sheds light on the most recent point we've been talking about, that's Theology for the Third Millennium. And then if you'd just like to read about him, you can look for his memoir, My Struggle for Freedom. Dr. Kung, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. You are a very well-informed interviewer. Thank you.
That is very kind. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owen's Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925, Owen's Funeral Home invites